Yes, you, listener. Did you know that everybody at History Hack works for free? And as much fun as that is, it would be great if we could garner just a little bit of support for all of the time and effort that goes into producing the show. I have a cat that needs food. Zach has Airfix models to buy. And Boney, well, Boney likes books. So if you can chuck us a couple of quid as a one-off via Ko-fi or subscribe to Patreon, we would much appreciate it. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. It feels like Lockie today. This is a little bit clickbaity because this is one people will dive on, isn't it?
I think it is. It's one of those classic history topics that just keeps coming up. So here we go. We're back onto it, and it's kind of in our wheelhouse a little bit. We're
It
into the
is because
world of
you guide this, don't you? I have once or
yeah.
twice.
I mean,
You guide this.
yeah, it feels a little bit like I don't know, going back in time. Because for a lot of London tour guides, this is kind of how we kind of get into things. Really, we get into the swing of things. It's the East End. It's 1888, and I don't know, we're back in the world of misty London and top hats almost, because we're drifting into the world of Jack the Ripper. All right, so with us we have Christine Ward Aegis, who's a researcher and retired public servant, and Jonathan Hainsworth, who's a history teacher and author as well. And they've worked on this piece, Jack the Ripper, or the escape of Jack the Ripper, which, well, it does sound like a classic kind of title within the genre. How are you, the two of you?
Very well, thank you. And thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
This is brilliant, Lockie, because I have to ask you guys, how do you touch this with a barge pole? Because everyone is obsessed with figuring out who it is, aren't they?
Yes. Can I just explain how I got into it?
Yeah,
Good idea.
please do, because Lockie and I, like, we go around, we state the facts, we give the list of the suspects when we do the tours, and then we back the hell away.
I'm a high school history teacher, and a number of years ago, I was just looking for something a bit different to introduce a British history of the 19th century, looking at imperialism and socialism and all those sort of isms. And I thought I might, just for a couple of lessons, do true crime. As you say, Jack the Ripper is very infamous, and it would give us an entree into the terrible conditions in London's East End that had forced women to become sex workers because there was no welfare support system. So I thought I'd start with that. And what happened was, in introducing the students to a few sources, a female student named Bianca put her hand up and she said, "There's a discrepancy in one of these sources." And to be honest, I was a bit annoyed because I just wanted to go smoothly and keep going. And she said, "How do you explain that?" And I said, I'm not sure. I don't know the topic well enough to, so I'll go away and try and figure it out." Because obviously, for a 16-year-old student to have seen this discrepancy, obviously adults over the decades must have noticed this discrepancy and they'll have figured it out. Or anyway, I looked at all the books. No one had ever noticed it before. And that was a surprise to me. And that's what got me in to trying to figure out what was going on with the original sources compared to what the books were written about. What she had noticed was that a police chief had written about the top suspect, Montague Druitt, that he was said to be a doctor. And because he was a young lawyer, it's always discredited that police chief as someone who doesn't know who he's talking about. Hence the need for finding other suspects. But what Bianca said was, "Yeah, but said to be a doctor, that's provisional. That's contingent, isn't it?" I went, "Well, I suppose." And she said, "Yeah, so said to be a doctor. So might be a doctor." And I went, "Well, yes, might be a doctor." And she said, "So might not be a doctor. And he isn't a doctor." And that was the whole thing rolling on from there, trying to research it and figure out. And it took me a few years to look at sources and compare them with what had been written and sort of work it out. I had to machete my way through a whole lot of things that I think and we think are wrong in the interpretation of the material. And that's when my students said, "Well, what you should do, because you've kind of figured it out or you've provided a persuasive argument, you should write a book, Mr. Hainsworth. You should write a book." And I thought, that's a
Just
good
like
idea.
that.
Well, that's right. And I thought, well, that's a good idea, but I have a better idea, which is don't write a book. Just always talk about writing a book. So that became my party piece. I'm going to write a book on Jack the Ripper. But when Christine and I got together, she had noticed me doing this several times. And she said, you're not really going to write that book, are you? And I went, well, no, but I'm talking about writing. And she said, look, I know.
She just basically said, you are a fraud.
Yes, bluff call.
Baloney, baloney. So she said, look, I know it's hard because you work full time and I work full. But look, if we do it together, that was the first book, I'll help you. And that's how it came about. And then she found a lot more material after the first book, which we argue proves conclusively that our interpretation is almost certainly correct. And that's the latest book that's come out that we're talking about today.
That's brilliant. Do we not have all this lucky with Crippen not being a doctor as well? It just seems to have been a thing. If you were a white male of a certain class with a certain amount of money and you just shoved that title in front of your name, no one called you on it.
Well, he was an educator, wasn't he? He did education. Like in my neck of the woods, actually, he was a Blackheath tutor or teacher for a time. And I just wonder if...
And a full-time barrister, a very successful barrister. And he was also very successful cricketer.
Yes. So, yeah, he played at Blackheath, that where the cricket club is the same as the old rugby club ground as well, Rectory Field. So, yeah, we've played on the same turf before.
But Jack the cricketer.
Lockie, take us away. I know, like, Lockie's going to have questions. So,
yes.
Well, I think we need to just set the context for the uninitiated. Not that I think there are that many uninitiated people, kind of, especially around us. But let's just talk about the context of the Jack the Ripper story a little bit, and actually kind of center it back on where we are with the debate now a little bit, because you don't really see books with this kind of title being published more. There seems to be a more kind of lean towards the victims and their lives and societal stuff. And you know, many would say rightly so, of course. But if we could do a kind of 5 minutes on the kind of Jack the Ripper basics, who the victims were and who else has been accused of that. Do you reckon you can do that?
Yes. In 1888, there were a series of murders, seven in 1888, might have been eight in 1888, of women who were driven into becoming sex workers because there was no other way they could live or sustain themselves. And so the first two, who Emma Smith and Martha Tabram, who are killed a few weeks apart from each other, they're almost certainly killed by gangs of young roughs who've robbed them and then killed them. Martha Tabram may have been killed by drunken soldiers, but they were heavily mutilated. And what we see in the press of that time is that until those two horrific murders, the attitude of the press, which reflected the establishment, was, well, they're nymphomaniacs, you know.
Typical Victorians, isn't it?
Yeah. It's blame the victim. They're fallen women. They're immoral. And this is what happens to them. But once those two murders happen, there begins to be this turnaround where the press are saying, this is horrible what has happened to these defenseless women. And you know what? Their lives were already destroyed by being in the East End and being in poverty. And then you get the murder of Polly Nichols at the end of August, and she is horribly mutilated post-mortem. The best argument is that the murderer strangled her quickly, lowered her body, and then began these terrible mutilations with a knife. And at that moment, the press explode in, well, hang on, here's another woman who's really been neglected. This is a victim of social neglect. And maybe the first two murders were actually by a maniac. So now suddenly the first murder, probably by the person who'll be called Jack the Ripper, becomes the third murder. So you now have a reign of terror in London as women are being dispatched who are sex workers in the East End. Actually, in a sense, that the fear is not well founded, because he doesn't seem to be attempting to murder women or women who are sex workers and therefore easy access in the street anywhere else in London. In fact, what is also noticed is that all the victims in 1888, after Polly Nichols, and in one night he manages to kill two women in one, and it was just a sense of siege in London. Two police forces, the Met and the City Police, were involved trying to catch him that night. But what they noticed was he was killing women, not just in Whitechapel, but in a tiny area of Whitechapel, a square mile that social reformers called the evil quarter mile, the worst slum of the worst slum. And the famous writer George Bernard Shaw wrote this letter to the newspaper in which he said, now he's being tasteless and he's being satirical, but he's saying, us social reformers who've been doing marches and writing pamphlets and making speeches, we've got nowhere. And then this single maniac, by dispatching some of these women so horribly, has converted the proprietary owning class, the property owning class, into some sort of form of primitive communism. Because now suddenly you've got people in Parliament going, it's terrible about the murders. But you know what else is terrible? East End poverty that we're not doing anything about. We need to move on sanitation. We need to move on congestion. We need to move on. So Shaw was saying, wow, this maniac's doing a better job than us. Now, he meant that satirically, because what he couldn't know was that the murderer was in fact not some sort of maniac who perhaps should have been committed to an asylum. He was in fact a member of the upper bourgeoisie. He was a member of the upper classes, upper middle class, to be specific. And we think that since he didn't, as you said, he lived in Blackheath, he didn't have to go anywhere near the East End, but he chose that because he's actually a terrorist. He's informed by left-wing ideas of the time, socialism, anarchism. There were various Irish nationalist groups who were trying to blow up Scotland Yard, blow up Parliament. So terrorism is very much a way of life and death in London at that time. So that was one of the things that was noticed in 1888. And so he kills a woman called Mary Jane Kelly, and that's the only one that's done in a room, her little hovel room, and she is torn to pieces. Even the public knows that, even though they're not allowed to know the details of what was done post-mortem. But this, again, is a terribly shocking murder. But it's also critical, the timing of the murder. He did it on Lord Mayor's Day. So that Lord Mayor's Day, where the city pretends that for one day we'll feed the poor, is spoiled, deliberately sabotaged, because here is a young woman of the people who has been torn to pieces. Now, the murders actually go on until 1891 with reduced frequency. So it isn't really an autumn of terror, as it's called. It's really a protracted affair that goes over a couple of years. And then they just seem to stop, the murders. 300 men were arrested and questioned. No one was ever charged. And then what we found in our research is that from 1891 onwards, a very famous writer of the day, as famous as Charles Dickens had once been, though not as good a writer, called George Sims. His column is read every Sunday, called Mustard and Cress. And what he starts writing, and everyone knows he has insider police contacts, is, well, you know what? Jack the Ripper, which was the name, by the way, didn't come from the murder. It came from a hoax letter by two journalists. He said, Jack the Ripper, you know, he might be dead. He was probably young. He was probably from the middle classes. He was probably a semi-professional figure, handsome and well-spoken. And he's probably taken his own life in a state of mental agony. Now, this wasn't noticed initially. It would take until the end of the decade, 10 years after the five murders that are attributed to one maniac, the other murders are copycats after 1888. It would take 10 years, and then a semi-official solution was provided to the public by a man called Major Arthur Griffiths, who was the chief warden of prisons and a crime writer. And his huge book, Mysteries of Police and Crime, came out, and everybody zeroed in on his introduction, in which he revealed a bombshell. And that was, well, you know how we thought the police had no good suspects? Actually, they had three. And the top one was a doctor, a middle-aged doctor who drowned himself in the Thames, and he would have been arrested and probably charged if he hadn't killed himself. And everyone's like, who's that? Who's this doctor? We've never heard of this figure before. And then George Sims comes in and saying, yeah, it was the doctor. He was a recluse, very rich, middle-aged, from a very prominent London family. He actually hadn't been a doctor for several years because he'd been in asylums. He should never have been let out. And his friends, that's right, we'll call them friends. They're trying to find him after that last murder, but his body then bobbed up in the Thames and the police with their dragnet were just a little too late. So to Edwardians into the 1900s, Jack the Ripper wasn't a mystery. They all knew who it was. They didn't know his name. That wouldn't be respectful of someone who was outside due process. But apart from that, they knew who it was. It was Jack the Gentleman. And this was very important, this leaking by this police chief to his writer friends, because what he was doing was saying, Jack the Ripper is not Jewish or an immigrant or someone poor or a convenient outsider. Jack the Ripper was one of us, not one of them, like it or lump it. He was a gentleman above suspicion, and he had some sort of mental illness, and eventually he took his own life as the police were closing on him. So that was important because a lot of people didn't like that solution, but, oh, well, it's sort of like Jekyll and Hyde. When the First World War came and went, that's when a lot of these people are deceased who know the truth. And when new researchers in the 1920s attempted to, well, let's find this drowned doctor. I mean, how hard can it be? He must be registered as a doctor who took his own life in the Thames. So they looked everywhere in various records. No such person existed. And therefore, a mistake was made in the 20s into the 1930s, which was, you know what? That whole story is bunkum. It's just made up as police propaganda to say, well, we didn't completely screw up the case. And by the time you get to the 1940s and 1950s, it's all forgotten about him being a suicide. And the image of Jack has become solidified in popular culture. As you said, a man with a top hat, a man with a cloak, a man with a medical bag. Actually, that part is a lie by the people who know the truth to avoid admitting it's actually a young barrister, which would have destroyed a very prominent Dorset-based family. And so when finally the notes that were left behind by that police chief, his daughter revealed it's Dan Farson in the late 50s, who was a television celebrity at that time. He didn't reveal the name. That was an American writer a few years later. But now for the first time, by the mid-60s, with Beatlemania, the name of the drowned doctor is finally revealed. And it's MJ Druitt, Montague John Druitt. And initially people went, okay, oh, well, we know now. Except he's a barrister. And he's not middle-aged. And he didn't kill himself, like all these stories say, the night of the Mary Jane Kelly atrocity. He did it 3 weeks later. So an assumption was made, understandable with limited resources, but wrong nonetheless, that Sir Melville McNaughton, the police chief, didn't know what he was talking about, didn't know who he was talking about. And the whole subject from that moment went in the wrong direction towards some plausible police suspects, and towards very outlandish and unlikely people. But our contention, just to finish, our contention is Sir Melville McNaughton is a reliable source, as is George Sims, as is members of the Druitt family. And therefore, of course, we can't prove Druitt was the killer. But he confessed to his cousin, who was a priest. And obviously, he knew things about the murders. I mean, McNaughton only had to hear from the family what Montague had, Montague was dead by the time he knew about him, but in his confession, he knew details about the murders that were unknown to anyone but the police and the murderer. So McNaughton, who loved cricket, by the way, couldn't say to them, look, your Montague was just delusional. He had to say, you're right, it is him. And that means that a prominent family will be destroyed if it can be identified in the media. And by the way, I have a very close friend, Colonel Sir Vivian Magendie, a bomb disposal expert against terrorists. And he, unfortunately, by marriage, is related to the Druitt clan. So we're going to have to cover this up. We're going to have to reveal it and yet conceal it at the same time.
Right. Lockie, how's that for a start?
I mean, in terms of the number of things that we're kicking at here, it's almost overwhelming. We've got you've got the kind of societal elements around it. We've also got classic Ripper themes of conspiracy, as well as the kind of class element to it all, which comes into it. I mean, you can't sort of have looked at the Ripper story at all without hearing various conspiracy theories. I mean, including royal ones. I mean, but the idea of Montague John Drew is not a new one completely. Oh. It's been kicked around for a lot of years now. What makes you so certain about it?
Did you want to? No, I'm ready.
It's cool, because the first thing you're going to get when you try and name the Ripper is skepticism from people.
Of course.
How do you put that down?
We say in the introduction of our book that we don't have evidence, hard evidence, forensic evidence. It's not a cold case study by us. What it is saying that there were certain Victorians, a handful, whom we try to show are reliable sources, and they believed Montague Druitt was Jack the Ripper. I mean, some of them were members of his own family. Families are usually the last people to believe that their member is a fiend. Ted Bundy's mother refused to believe it, even after her son had confessed to murdering 40 women 2 days before he was executed in America. She still said he's just made it up.
Let's talk about the family then. You know, what about them? Let's tell us a little bit about those guys.
Well, the Druitt family were what you might call a very good family. They were upper middle class, and they've made their money through hard work. And they were mainly doctors, lawyers,
soldiers,
priests. Monty's family came from Dorset, and his father was the local doctor or the local surgeon. And the Druitt family had been there for generations. They came from the Mayo and Druitt clan.
You get the Mayo Clinic, the later generations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Monty went to Winchester College and was a really good student, and he was also a terrific sportsman, playing cricket, fives,
tennis,
football, everything. He was a real all-rounder, and he was in the debating club and the Shakespeare club, and there's a lot that we found out about him from the archives of Winchester College. So they were really good in providing,
and new photos that had never been published before.
Yeah, so we found out a lot about him. When he was at college, he was taught by a fellow called Arthur de Borlay Hill. He was a reverend there, and his sister goes on to marry Monty's cousin Charles Druitt, and that's how the Magendie and the Druitt family become
a connected clan.
And that's where you bring in Sir Vivian Magendie, who was the bomb disposal expert, and then the friend of George Sims and Melville McNaught.
They're like a trio of fellows who are close friends. They're all members of the upper classes. They love going to the boxing and the football and the cricket together.
So these family connections are something that we found out, and no one had sat down and worked that out before. And the reason why that's important is that when Sir Melville McNaughton was told, we think by Montague's aunt probably and cousin, that Monty was the Ripper, he had every reason to bury that, because his best friend was a member of that family, Vivian Magendie. The Druitt family in London, Dr. Robert Druitt was a famous physician, highly respected.
This is Montague's uncle.
That is his uncle. And looking at old newspapers, his name's in the newspaper nearly every day, endorsing healthy wine to drink. And
he is an unusual physician, upper-class physician in Victorian England, because he's known to classes upstairs and downstairs because of his advocacy for light wines. And so his name is used all the time in every newspaper in advertisements, even after he's deceased. So we think that when Montague, when he went anywhere and he said his name was Druid, the first question he would inevitably be asked would be, oh, are you related to Dr. Druid, Dr. Robert Druid? Yes, I'm one of his nephews. And we think that helped get him off the hook when he was arrested the night he murdered two women in Whitechapel, probably with an apology.
So let's talk about, he's not tried. I mean, he's never picked up and tried. And you've already mentioned because he kills himself. So when does he do that? And what are the, you're saying it's mental health. What are the circumstances?
What a researcher called R.J. Palmer in America discovered was a newspaper article in the Philadelphia Times that showed that an American reporter had picked up stuff in Paris that somebody from England had been brought across by members of their family to be put into a mental institution, a very expensive asylum just outside of Paris. And while the name Druid is not used, in fact, all the names are false, there are so many details in that story that match things about Montague Druid and his family that we make a circumstantial case in the book in a chapter called English Patient that Druid had, after the horrific murder of Mary Kelly, he was in a state of implosion, and he confessed to his cousin, and the cousin and Montague's older brother of 1 year, they thought, right, our family will be destroyed by this. So we don't want him to harm anyone else, and we'll take him to France under an assumed name. We'll pay them off a lot of money. Unfortunately, one of the male nurses there was English and could understand everything he was saying and went straight to the French constabulary in order to collect the reward. So he had to be extricated once again from the French asylum back to London. And a week or so later, they put him in an English asylum in Chiswick. Now, the police didn't have the name. The British police went to France. He had already absconded. They went back to England. They're checking all private asylums, which is quite a thing to do when you think of the wealthy people who put their relatives in such places. And mental illness was something to be ashamed of then. And so to suddenly have the police turning up and asking questions about when were they admitted and who are they is quite a, but they felt they had to do it because they were hot on his trial. And we think that Montague at this asylum called the Manor House in Chiswick, he was aware, he was lucid again, and he thought, I'm not going to have my family destroyed. So he just walked the 10 metres that the manor house was situated next to the River Thames and just walked in and drowned himself by putting rocks in his pockets. This was on December 4th, and his body surfaced at the end of the month and was retrieved on December 31st, 1888. And at the inquiry, 2 days later, the local coroner was actually known. This was a source that it was, Christine's the one who finds everything. And she discovered that the coroner, Dr. Diplock, was very well known to the Druitt family. No one has ever discovered that before. And that is why he lets the brother say a blatant lie at that inquiry. He says, my late brother Montague, he had no other relatives except me and our mother, who has been institutionalized since July with a degenerative mental condition. So he looks very honest saying something like that. What, of course, he's not saying, with the press all there with their pencils ready with their paper, they were thinking, is this Montague Druitt related to Dr. Druitt? Oh, the answer is no. That was a lie. He was lying at that inquiry through his teeth, desperate to not have the family name implicated by any connection to Jack the Ripper. And it was very successfully covered up at that point. The problem for the family was other copycat murders were being done. And Montague Druitt's aunt, the widow of Dr. Robert Druitt, thought, well, we can't have someone else be hung for this. What are we going to do? What can we do? And Charles, who'd taken the confession and was an Anglican reverend, he was like, well, Montague said to me, in 10 years, the truth must come out. Maybe it should come out earlier. And when Melvin McNaughton intersected with all this, because he's got his friend Magendie, who would be who would be, his name would be tarnished by being connected with the Druids and Jack the Ripper. Also, Melvin McNaughton, who's a fascinating figure in his own right, is a very unusual police chief in that time because he's upper class. His father was one of the chairmen of the East India Company. He had been to Eton College and remained a sort of Hooray Henry, old Etonian his whole life. But it meant that at Scotland Yard, he outranked everybody by class. And so his attitude was, right, I'm taking control of the cover-up so that you are protected, my friend Majendie is protected, I'll make sure no one else is hung for it. And if it comes to it and we have to release details, we will make the details a little bit different from who, we'll still say he was a gentleman, but we'll say he was a middle-aged doctor, then he'll never be found.
Lockie, where do you want to go next?
I'm just thinking about kind of other suspects and kind of how that ties in and, yes. and what was, you know, supported by kind of revelations like that as it happens. I'm still curious about the family, though, to a degree. I mean, how did they become aware of his connection to the murders?
Well, we think that he confessed to his cousin Charles. Charles actually was a reverend in
Dorset.
In Whitchurch, and they were close. And Monty had always visited the Druitt family in Kensington when he was working at Blackheath, and also he had chambers in King's Bench Walk.
Yeah.
That they were his legal chambers,
which is near the East End, of course.
We've got letters that tell us that they were a close family. And in the West End, King's Bench. So we know there was a close relationship there. Now, we believe that Monty did confess to Charles, and that's when...
We have sources for that. Mm. There is a vicar who in 1899 sends a letter to the Daily Mail, and he says, I know who Jack the Ripper is, and this is my... letter on it, because the murderer wanted, after 10 years, for some of the truth to come out. But the vicar says, however, I'm going to mix fact with fiction to protect the innocent. And the Daily Mail are like, well, we don't publish stories that are made up, at least so blatantly. Mm-hmm. And so they send a reporter up north, and we believe that this is Arthur de Borlay Hill, who was Montague Druitt's brother-in-law, and Charles Druitt's brother-in-law. Sorry, and he meets the vicar, and the vicar says, "I knew him well. He went to the East End as part of a rescue mission of fallen women, and because of a mental disease he had, they became his victims. And I can't say any more than that, except that at one time he was a doctor. Now you can't at one time." Be a doctor. You're either a doctor and perhaps you're qualified, but you don't practice. But the term doctor was used interchangeably, we discovered, with medical student. And so we discovered evidence that Montague Druitt had been a medical student. He dropped out. He had done a civil service exam, done well, but then never went into the civil service. He chose law in the end. So the vicar is saying to the journalist, if you don't want to publish it, don't publish it. And they're like, well, we probably won't publish it, but we'll publish an article about how we can't publish it. So we'll whinge about it in our paper and we'll quote from your letter. And just as he's leaving, the vicar said, oh, just one thing. Do you mind not publishing my name? Because my name could lead to the identification of the murderer. He had called his article for them the White Church Murders. As if to say, see, I'm mixing fact and fiction. We all know it's Whitechapel, with the people of Daily Mail scratching their head thinking, what is this Dotty Vicar on about? Well, Whitechurch is the name of Charles Druitt, Montague's cousin's parish in Dorset. So he is pointing towards, you know, my name might give it away. I mean, his name's de Borlay Hill, not Druitt, but he's saying, please don't publish it because it might give it away. And we think the only reason they didn't do a proper investigation of the whole thing was that it involved the Church of England. And that just wasn't worth it for them in the end. So this vicar remains this strange, anomalous source, but we have found other sources that match it. One of the people who took the English patient to France for that French asylum was a man who identified himself as, I am the patient's cousin, and I'm a reverend.
Lockie's like, I can see Lockie's brain whirring at this point.
It's just whenever you hear kind of new kind of elements on this, I'm trying to sort of figure out how this fits in with it all. So, I mean, the people involved in this cover-up then, we've got McNaughton, we've got Sims.
Colonel Magendie, Sims.
Magendie, yeah. There's a Henry Farquharson as well, isn't there?
Yes.
Ferguson.
Henry Farquharson is an MP, a Tory MP, a backbencher. And in 1891, he starts telling his 10 best friends in London, I know who Jack the Ripper is. Right. He's a man, he's a gentleman who committed suicide. And it leaks to the press. So the press do this small article going, they don't name Farquharson initially, they do later, saying there's an MP who's going around saying, it's almost like his doctrine, I know who it is, I have solved it. Now, what we discovered about Farquharson is that he really is a revolting, tough figure, but he lived 9 miles from the Druids. And we think that what happened was Charles went to him, a bit like the brother of the Unabomber went to an FBI agent and said, I think the manifesto's by someone I know, but I don't want him to be executed. We think Charles Druitt and probably his mother, Isabella, went to the MP and said, look, we're trying to have our cake and eat it too. We want you as an officer of the state to tell the police that please don't connect anyone else with those 5 murders in 1888 because they were done by our late cousin. And Farquharson went, thank you for that, and went straight to his gentleman's club in London and blabbed to everyone. And that's what brought McNaughton in, because they're both old Etonians. And McNaughton, when he met the Druids, we think that what he said was, well, we can bury this. It never has to come out at all. And they went, no, Vicar Charles is determined to fulfill Montague's dying wish, or next to dying wish, that it come out in 10 years. And that's when McNaughton thought, all right, we've got a few years to come up with a cover story that will quash the vicar. And so George Sims came out in 1899 and said, this vicar doesn't know what he's talking about. And yet they've got the same suspect.
So what effect does this have on the family then? Because eventually it does come out. And where do they end up? How does it go for them afterwards?
They're all deceased by the time Druitt's name comes out in 1965. There was a son who was a nephew who was about to be awarded, I think, a knighthood in 1965. That was awkward. And yet none of the press made the connection that, well, your name's Druitt. And this American book, Autumn of Terror, has named Melvin McNaughton's notes as saying it's MJ. I mean, imagine today with the internet and it would just be instant. There would be microphones shoved in this guy's face saying, was your uncle Jack the Ripper? Should you deserve this knighthood? But it just didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
And it'd be all over Twitter.
It'd be all over Twitter.
He even knew what hit him, wouldn't it?
But can I just say something else that Christine, she found all these sources. And one of the sources she found, never found before, was that Barrister Montague Druitt had himself defended a murderer in court. The year before the murderer started, he defended a murderer, a child murderer, and he tried to blame the murder on that man's, his client's wife, who was obviously innocent. She was also a sex worker. And he did such a terrible demolition job on her, even though she's not on trial, that she had to leave town for her own safety.
Well, that'll add weight to a kind of misogyny element, wouldn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yes.
Oh, this is just, Lockie, you are a skeptic usually when people say they think they know who Jack the Ripper is. Are you at least moved to like seriously consider this? I know you're a historian and you're going to want to match the Druitt stuff up against evidence for other people and that. But in isolation, are you open to the possibility that this guy might be Jack the Ripper?
To be honest, I've been open to a lot of theories throughout, to the point where I'm almost in the I don't care who did it kind of camp a little bit, in the sense that I how to put this, the kind of work that gets done around there most of the time, that there's a like quite a big kick around against the kind of Jack the Ripper element to Whitechapel and Spitalfields, where I do tours. And a lot of what I do now, say for example, I'm taking a group of school kids around there. If I'd done it 10 years ago, yeah, it would have been Jack the Ripper and here's where happened. But now it's really quite different. In fact, and we look a lot more at the kind of societal elements, the kind of immigration in the area, the kind of anti-Jewish sentiment. And if we do look at suspects, it'll often be centered on the kind of Russian, Polish, Jewish visitors or recent arrivals that had so much hostility directed towards them as well. And that's kind of where we'll put the focus. And funnily enough, you know, outwardly at least, that's where the police put a lot of the focus at the time as well. They added a lot of witness statements saying, oh, you know, some swarthy-looking Eastern European.
The best witness statement, the best witness statement was by Joseph Lavendi, because he's only about 8 minutes between talking, seeing Catherine Eddowes, the fourth, third victim, talking to a young man whom this Jewish-Polish witness, described as about 5'7", about 30, fair. He is a fair complexion. And a fair moustache. So he appears to be a Gentile, not a Jewish person, by ethnicity. And then the next time the bobby comes around 8 minutes later, that woman has been in the, you know, cowed, blitz attack, ripped to pieces by, we believe, Montague Druitt. So the best witness description, for what that's worth in witness descriptions, fits Druitt. But we come back always to this. We don't know that Montague Druitt was Jack the Ripper. How could we? We're just saying they believed it was, and not only did they believe it was, they shared their solution with the public. For Edwardians, there was no mystery. It was rebooted as a mystery in the 1930s. That's what fascinates us.
Yeah, I think the honest answer to the question that Alex put to me is, I've found this kind of plausible for some time, but, you know, there's a lot of plausible stories around it. And I don't think you can know for sure either. But the story keeps going. And
they had every reason, the family, McNaughton, George Sims, Magendi, for it not to be Druitt. They didn't want it to be Druitt. So for them to say it is Montague, now what do we do now, is arguably human proof that it is him, that the evidence matches up, unfortunately for us. The other thing I would say is, McNaughton is actually the source for all the other suspects in that era. And he tells all the other people involved, particularly Dr. Robert Anderson, his boss, whom he loathed. He tells them all that, yes, it's that suspect, Aaron Kosminski. Yes. Because I found Aris Kosminski, he says. But he knowing Anderson was a Victorian prude par excellence, he says to him, well, he died in asylum, knowing full well he's still alive in the asylum, and he was involved in chronic masturbation. And at that moment, Anderson went, Mac, that's him. That's Jack the Ripper. Because any man who would abuse their own body against the Lord is capable of anything. I mean, that's what Anderson wrote.
I love the Victorian. The Victorians are as mucky as anyone, yet you can't trust the guy who jerks one off. You can't.
Absolutely. Whereas McNaughton, he'd grown up at Eton. He knew all about that sort of thing.
And I wrote a book on Eton. They're at it too. I'm telling you now, the amount of source material and accounts I've read about boys at Eton, they're all at it.
And McNaughton had his neighbour was Oscar Wilde. And even after Oscar Wilde was disgraced,
he's definitely at it.
He called him a genius. It was fashionable to just call him a degenerate, but McNaughton always said, no, he was a genius. And so he was actually quite an unusually sophisticated police figure about such matters. So he handed Anderson, Jack the Masturbator, to get him as far away from looking anywhere near the Druitts. If you look at all the suspects from that era, everybody says, yes, this is who Jack the Ripper was. And by the way, he's dead. He probably committed suicide. All the other suspects are actually alive. Only Montagu Druitt was deceased in a suicide. It's something, because McNaughton never conferred with other Scotland Yard people about what he knew, because his attitude was, because it'll leak, of course. We just keep it close to our chest as gentlemen.
I love the concept that, guys, I can reveal to you that Jack the Ripper was a man who masturbated. No shit.
He masturbated himself into an early grave. That's what he told Innocent. That's him, Mac. Behold the man.
I need to issue some warnings to some of the guys in my rugby team in that case.
Yeah. I just finally, before we go, this is really interesting. And even if you are like Lockie, you want to keep your options open, you've got to at least read the case that people put, haven't you, for certain individuals. You've been talking on and off about some of the sources, and some of them are so niche, like to find a newspaper letter 12 years later, or to find sort of to go back and look at family letters for people that might be connected to a suspect. I mean, you have done your due diligence in terms of sources and not just pontificating theories, haven't you?
Absolutely. And we've
actually I haven't.
Yeah.
I just pontificated.
Christine done this. Yeah. She appears to be bloody good at it as well.
We've done the 20-hour flight to London 3 times to actually go and read those letters.
Go to East London 3 times all the way from Australia as a South Londoner, I'm saying that's dedication.
I spent a lot of time down in Chichester, so that was lovely, reading letters.
Can we just say something against Q?
You wouldn't be like first.
Well, we went to the records, it's at Q.
The archive.
And then when we'd finished, We Christine had some trouble with her feet then, and my eyesight, it doesn't look it, but it's actually better now than it was.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get a cab. Like, no one would come. They rang people. We rang, but they said, yeah, we're not going to queue. But where are we in queue? All these gardens? Is this the Badlands? It's getting dark.
It's the opposite of the Badlands.
Of course it is. But they were like, we're not doing Q.
Gentrified the Druitt family.
No way. Where are you, Q? No way. And so finally, this Welsh taxi driver came and picked us up. I don't mean from Wales.
Come a long way.
Jeremy.
He's become a friend of ours because we just don't know what to do.
Because he's the only person who would come and rescue.
Only person.
He's the only one.
And even he said, I feel sorry for you because you are in Q. No one will help you then.
I don't understand. I'm like, do you know how much the house goes for in queue?
Where are these Druitt type people with knives?
I think they all have their own drivers, I think is the problem.
But it's like if someone dies and leaves you a house in queue, you're smug, right?
That's what we thought looking around. Why is, not queue, no way. You can walk.
Christine, Jonathan, we do have to wrap up. Now, sure. this has been fun. Like, it's a grim old topic, and it is unbelievably heavy, really, when you do end up getting into it. So just to bring it back to seriousness for a second, I mean, the story of these women, the ones killed, is just awful, but they were kind of the lives that they lived around then as well, and kind of the situations they were forced into is harsh, and I believe that comes through in your work, but also kind of the elements that we keep discussing, keep coming around, have come through in this. So we've got a new classic of the genre potentially here,
and we think the best justice for the victims is to name their killer, not let him get away with it.
Yeah.
Arguably. Okay. I mean, and can we just? You're great and everything, Jonathan, but Christine, well done for giving him a foot up the arse and making him actually put his head where
it's I completely agree.
Yeah,
I still have the imprint.
Guys, once again, tell us what the book is called.
The Escape of Jack the Ripper, The Truth About the Cover-Up and His Flight from Justice. The word escape means he escaped by committing suicide.
Yeah. Took the coward's way out.
Yes.
The book will be available on our online bookstore. Buy it from there. This is now Zach's regular pitch. Do not buy it from Jeff Bezos because he'll just spend it on rocket fuel and we don't like him anyway. If you buy it from bookshop.org, not only do Jonathan and Christine get a cut, History Hack gets a cut as well, and we support independent booksellers. So do trot over there and get yourself a copy. Guys, this has been so much fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.